You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3WBTV.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you will hear an interview with Vermont author Nancy Kilgore, whose new novel is Wild Mountain, published by Green Writers Press. Nancy Hayes Kilgore lives and writes in Burlington, Vermont, and has a psychotherapy practice in Hanover, New Hampshire. In her therapy practice, she incorporates the spiritual and creative dimensions and emphasizes mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. Nancy Hayes Kilgore is the winner of the 2016 Vermont Writers Prize. Her writing has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize, and her first novel, Sea Level, was a Forward Reviews Book of the Year. Formerly a parish pastor, Nancy leads workshops on writing and spirituality for clergy, therapists, and writers throughout the United States. She lives in Vermont with her husband, a painter. When I spoke with Nancy last week, I first asked her to read from Wild Mountain, a passage about a covered bridge. And actually, I want to just read to you a little bit about Wild Mountain before we get to that. Vermonter Mona Duval loves the covered bridge beside her store. She loves local history and the rugged, rural nature of her home state. But when an ice storm collapses the bridge, she is bereft. Frank McFarland, a seasonal resident who is beguiled by Mona, lends his political expertise to help rebuild the bridge, but they meet with powerful opposition. Tensions arise in the town, compounded by resistance to the soon-to-be-voted-on Freedom to Marry Bill, and then, unexpectedly, Mona's abusive ex-husband arrives. Wild Mountain is a page-turning, beautifully written novel about the love between Frank and Mona, the love of place, freedom to marry, and freedom from the past. By a writer whose prose has been compared to Alice Munro's. So, once again, Wild Mountain was published by Green Writers Press, and I spoke with Nancy Hayes Kilgore last week, and I asked her to read from Wild Mountain, and this is a passage about the covered bridge. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Mona would ride her bike over the hump at Hemlock Hill, coast down Wild Mountain Road, and see this gorgeous covered bridge shining in the light of a June evening when the grass was new and the peepers sang their heedless chorus and the river lapped soft over the rocks. She absorbed the graceful curves of its entry arches, the earthiness of its weathered siding, the swallows nesting in its eaves, and the delight of looking out at the swimming hole from its window. She noticed that whenever she went out on her bike, she'd end up at the bridge. At the library, she started studying its history and that of other covered bridges in Vermont. And by the age of 17, Mona Duval had become the foremost expert on the covered bridge of Wild Mountain, Vermont.
Great. Thank you so much for reading that little snippet about this incredible bridge. So I wondered if you have always been drawn to the bridges in Vermont, and if that's what, you know, encouraged you to write this, and if you had to do a lot of research on the old covered bridges.
I did do some research, and what started, and actually what began the idea for the short story that preceded this book was... In, I think it was 1998, there was an article in the newspaper about the covered bridge at Tunbridge, mm-hmm. and there was an ice storm that year, and the covered bridge at Tunbridge was knocked over by the ice jam. So that intrigued me. I thought that there's a story there, and so that eventually that worked into Wild Mountain.
Oh, interesting. Because I thought maybe it was the one in Queechy that was knocked out by Irene.
Yeah.
Which is different, completely kind of storm.
That was knocked over by the flood.
Yeah.
The floodwaters.
Right.
But probably, or maybe similar in the sense that, you know, in Wild Mountain, it sort of triggers a town conflict.
Yes.
Over whether to rebuild the bridge or not.
Right, and so that was fascinating to me. This, I'm skipping ahead a little bit in my questions, but I was so surprised to hear that the cost of building this covered bridge, rebuilding, would be $900,000. Is that true? Is that what they cost?
I think that is true. Yeah, I did research that.
That is crazy. I had no idea how expensive they are to build.
Yeah.
Wow. But of course, they have to be able to withstand a lot of years and a lot of weight. But that, they are extraordinary. But okay. Anyway, I really enjoyed that the covered bridges were such a strong theme in the book because I love them. And I thought that this was a very believable conflict for a town to get into because, of course, you know, we are so attached to the lovely aspects of our towns and the very Vermont aspects of our towns, and yet money is tight, right? Mm-hmm. So that was a really...
And people tend to divide up on either side of a conflict like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, even as, I don't know if you remember this part, but during the town meeting where they're arguing about it, Mona says to Frank, you know, it's not surprising because this town argued for a year about whether to raise the taxes 50 cents to buy a new dump truck or something.
Right. Yeah. So let's talk. So you mentioned Mona and Frank. So let's talk a little bit about Mona Duval as your main character. And I loved her. I loved her personality, her history. She's just a really real character. Like, she comes across as very real. She owns and runs a country store in this town. And I wondered if you can talk about developing her character and what inspired you to write about Mona.
Yeah, that's a good question because the book began with Frank, who is the outsider coming into the town.
Yeah.
And I wanted somebody to contrast with him, and Mona, you know, and a love interest, and Mona was the stable, and I had known someone whose dream was to have a country store, a woman, so I sort of put Mona into that position. And
then did she just sort of gain prominence as you were writing? I mean, do you agree that she's your main character?
She is.
I mean, Frank is very much a main character too, but I feel like we are much more in her narrative perspective as we read the book.
Yeah.
So did she just kind of take over, or how did that go?
Yeah, because my original idea in writing this short story was that I wanted to write from a man's point of view, something I hadn't done before.
Right.
And so that's where I started with Frank. And then Mona came in, and as the book developed, I think I got I got a lot more into Mona's point of view.
Yeah, interesting. Although I did think you did a beautiful job with Frank. You, very early in the book, I love Frank, and I think I started liking him because Mona does. But he has this epiphany early in the book, which is not necessarily early in his life, but he realizes at a certain point that he does not want to be alone when he's old. And I just thought that was a very real feeling for someone in Frank's position to be feeling and to be thinking about. And I liked that was introduced early in the book. I also liked that he had these qualities. Frank has qualities that are very positive, but also he has some negative qualities, you know, and he's not perfect. And I liked that. It made him very real. He's kind and intelligent and adventurous, but he's got a lot of addictions and he makes some foolish choices in his life. And it made him just very real to me. So that feeling that he didn't want to be alone when he's old, is that, well, I know you've been a pastor, and I wondered if maybe part of the inspiration for some of the characteristics of your characters comes from having worked with people in different times of their life, stressful times, or as they're getting older, and if that's inspired you to write that for Frank.
Maybe. I think I've just known a lot of people who, when they turn 50, men in particular, suddenly realize, oh, I've lived this, you know, adventurous life, and I've gone to all these places, and I love doing that, but do I want to do that for the rest of my life? And
is it time to settle down?
maybe I don't. And so Frank was kind of going through that transition period of life.
Okay, all right, great. You have a website, and I just wanted to quote something that's on your website. You write, "In my fiction writing, I like to integrate the psychological and spiritual, not through exposition or talking about the issues, but through exploring how these dimensions play out in the ways my characters live their lives. And I love that. And I wondered if you can talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah. In my first novel, Sea Level, it was about two women. One was a clergywoman and one was an artist. And they became involved in a church conflict and another community conflict. But at the same time, they were both in their early to mid-30s and kind of also going through a life transition and dealing with their spiritual sense of who am I in the world and what's my, you know, relationship to spirit or God or whatever. And so I guess because I've been in... I'm a clergywoman. Mm-hmm. I've been a parish pastor, and so I've always been, you know, immersed in the spiritual life to some degree. And so that's really important to me, and it comes out in my characters.
Yeah. And you're also a psychotherapist.
Right.
So do you do the same thing within your practice of psychotherapy, where you sort of try to let your spiritual side help you be a guide for people, or do you kind of avoid introducing that?
Yeah, and that's a good question too, because as a pastoral counselor, you know, you're not the sort of old-fashioned way of the priest and the as a guide, you know, would be to, you know, tell people what to do and tell people, you know, here's what you have to do to be saved or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But of course our training now is completely almost the opposite, where we're focusing on what's important to you in your spiritual life, and you know what experiences have you had, and you know, when a loved one dies, what are you feeling, you know, is going to happen to them, or mm-hmm. you know, how does the grief work with your spiritual life, and just you know, knowing such a variety of spiritual experiences that people have, you know, you can.
Yeah.
Help people kind of process all that.
Yeah. I wondered, so early in the book, there's this wonderful scene where Frank, this is such a perfect Frank moment, too, because he's trying to rescue a moose calf
mm-hmm.
that is stranded on an ice floe in the storm. And he's had a little too much to drink, and he's being a little bit more confident than perhaps is wise. Mm-hmm. And then he gets into some trouble, and so the emergency workers come to help him. So it was a great scene. It was really well done. And I wondered if you've ever been in an emergency rescue situation.
No.
No? It was just really well done. So did you just sort of, like, imagine how that would be, or have you...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know, you know, in Vermont, you know the EMT people.
Yeah.
I mean... And you know, I've heard descriptions, and
yeah.
you know, in Vermont, we're all so connected that
that's true.
Hear all these stories.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, early on in the book, you do sort of introduce an antagonist, and that's Mona's ex, Johnny O.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what you think about him and how he came to you, and how you know. It's funny. I was trying to figure out if I thought that they seemed like they would have been good together, you know, in the far distant past when they were together. And I could see what she was attracted to about him, but then he's kind of not a very nice character now. So
yeah.
I wonder if you can just talk a little bit about him.
Yeah, he's the least sympathetic, the evil guy, but yeah, she. There's so many women, so many of us, who have had abusive relationships in the past, so it just seemed like a natural for her. And then the fact that her father had been abusive, there's just a,
right.
you know, a mention of that. And actually, in my first version, or maybe my umpteenth version, before the final version, Johnny O wasn't present.
Oh.
And that there wasn't that kind of tension about him, the suspense. And
oh, yeah, he's very, like, that's a very suspenseful story thread right from the start.
Yeah.
It's like, what's going to happen with this guy?
So he was mentioned as, you know, part of her past. So then in my final version, I realized, oh, I'll bring him into the story.
But that must have taken some time to add him in.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. Okay. Did you have pretty much this final draft before you went to publication, or before you submitted to Green Writers, or did they give you editorial notes and you had to make a lot of changes?
It was pretty much the final draft.
Yeah.
And I'd actually hired an independent editor.
Oh, okay.
Before I submitted it.
Yeah.
And that helped a lot.
Okay. And then I was curious, the story that you wrote that turned into this novel, is that the story that won the prize? You won a prize with Green Mountain Power, correct?
Mm-hmm. The Vermont Writers' Prize.
Vermont Writers' Prize.
Yeah.
Okay. And so what year was that?
That was 2016.
Okay.
And no, there was an excerpt from Wild Mountain that I used to submit to that, and it was I don't know if you remember the part where Mona is at the bulletin board.
Yes.
And she's reflecting, and she finds a quote by Rumi.
Yes.
And she reflects on that.
Yeah.
And you know where she's at in her life with these different men, the men in her past, and then Frank coming in, and her reluctance to, you know, engage with Frank.
Okay. Okay. So is that when you say this started out as a story, was that the story, or there was a story, then it became a novel, and then you chose that excerpt to submit to them?
Mm-hmm. No, the original story was really the first two chapters.
Okay.
About the covered bridge, the bridge hadn't even fallen down yet. It was just Frank, you know, getting rescued by Mona.
Okay. All right. Did you have any sort of community of support that was reading this as you wrote it and giving you feedback or encouragement?
Oh, yes. Writers groups.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. How many writers groups are you in?
Well, now I'm in a couple of writing groups, but as I was writing it, the first version, actually, I like to write the first draft myself, and then get feedback on each chapter. And then I go back and revise. But for this novel, after I'd gotten that first draft, I did an exchange with someone who had also written a novel, and we exchanged chapters and gave each other feedback.
Oh, smart. Okay, now how did you find that person?
Well, I'm a part of the Presbyterian Writers Guild online, and she and I were both at similar places in having, you know, finished a first draft.
Okay.
And she's actually in Washington State.
Oh, wow.
So I've never met her in person.
Oh, that's interesting. Would you think you ever will, like at a conference or anything?
I hope so. Yeah. I hope we'll meet.
Yeah.
Because her novel was wonderful, her first novel.
Yeah.
And this is her second novel. That we were both on our second novels.
And has she published her novel?
Yeah, her first one.
So can we say what her name and her title are?
Her name is Ruth Linnea Whitney, and her first novel is Slim. It's a wonderful novel. It's about a town in Africa, and it's a wonderful story about a cross-cultural experience in Africa during the AIDS crisis.
Okay. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your mix of real facts and real places and fictional facts and fictional places. So you have the Abenusik River, you have Wild Mountain. Those are fictional places, I assume. But then you also have Governor Snelling is mentioned and you know, some real places and some real, you know, history. So how did you decide what to fictionalize in the book?
Well, I really just wanted a small town in the Green Mountains. And I didn't want anybody to identify a town that I have lived in or, you know, that's a real town. So tried to sort of make it sound realistic, but not specifically in this place or that.
Right. Right. And I suppose the fact that it's a town in conflict means that you certainly wouldn't want to, you know, say, okay, this is, you know, I don't know.
I think there are a lot of small towns in Vermont who would identify with a town conflict.
Yes. Yeah. So I was going to ask, what are your your own favorite Vermont country stores? Do you have any favorite Vermont country stores?
Oh, that's an interesting question, too.
Because Mona owns a country store, I should just
mention. Mona owns a country store, and I think there's a store in Stratford, Vermont, that I was visualizing when I was thinking of this store, although it's where it's set is very different in the landscape.
Yeah.
But it has that kind of charm and character.
Yeah.
I loved your chapter endings, and I wanted to talk to you about that. Now, not every single one was like any other one, but you had... You left us with either a very warm sense in each chapter or a sense of wanting to know more. I thought that you did that very, very well. And often it was just lovely prose or a kind of sweet view on life. And I'll just offer a few examples. So this is the end of chapter 4. She picked up a twig and threw it into the water, watching as it rushed downstream, bobbing and jumping around the ice, vanishing into the night river. And that's great. You know, that's right when she's very worried about this bridge and she finds out that her ex might have come to town. And that just was this lovely way to end that chapter. I thought that was great. And then this is at the end of chapter 7. I think this is Frank. Yeah. As he paused beneath the dense canopy of hemlock boughs, the cool silence of the woods was broken only by the plaintive screech of an owl in the distance, and for the first time in a while he sensed a feeling of gratitude, a feeling that seemed to rise out of the wet snow, the smell of the pine woods and the last rays of the sun, something akin to prayer. Thank God for the snow, for the quiet, for Erica, his only family, and for his cabin in Vermont. I loved that. It made me feel grateful. And I'll do one more here. So here's Mona at the end of chapter 8. From here, the town of Wild Mountain was a winding stream and a tiny church steeple, just one spot in this vast magnificence, these mountains and hills and valleys of Vermont. She's looking out over a view. Anyway, I just noticed that about not all of your endings. Then there are some endings that are a call to action or something that's said in dialogue. But do you think about that as you end a chapter, that you're trying to establish a certain sense of what's just happened or what's to come or encouraging us forward?
Yeah, I think so. I think that sense of ending with a scene and something in nature that's sort of a spiritual experience, in a sense, that somebody is having is a way of you know, closing up the chapter, a way of ending it, and then, you know, I think you realize there's got to be more because the person is sort of on the verge of some decision or some action.
Right. Yeah. Do you tend to write chapter by chapter? Like, do you tend to sort of, you know, encapsulate a period of time in your work within a chapter, and then you're finished and you get up and you leave your desk and you're going to work again another point?
Yes, I think I do.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you read your work back to yourself after you've finished a section at a time, or do you kind of push on through to a full draft before you let you read it again?
I read over and over and over again.
Yeah. Okay.
Which really slows me down. I mean, I keep thinking, oh, I should just keep going, but...
Yeah. That's my style, too. I read over and over and over, and I think that I edit as I go, and then my revisions tend to be a little bit different than they might be otherwise, because when I revise... It's not necessarily on the sentence level anymore. I'm more revising a larger
part. I think I do that too.
Yeah. But it is slow going.
Yeah. Yeah, but when you go back to it, you know, you're reading, here's what I've done, and I'm going to go on from here.
Mm-hmm.
But I get stuck in, here's what I've done. Oh, I've got to fix this. I've got to fix that. I've got to, you know, that doesn't sound quite right.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. This is an interview with Vermont author Nancy Hayes Kilgore. If you're enjoying this show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thank you so much. Stay tuned for the rest of the interview. We are streaming on 99.3 WBTV.org.
Talk a little bit, if you would, about developing a romance in fiction.
Oh, you know, that was fun. As I said, I started out, I wanted two very different people to come together and, you know, to be attracted to each other and see what happens. And, of course, Frank's attracted to Mona because she's so different from him. She's, you know, stable and grounded and
you know, lived in Vermont all her life, but she's also very attractive, of course. And, you know, he's at this turning point in his life where that looks good to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he wants to settle down, even though his life has been completely different. He's traveled and he's done different things. And so Mona's attracted to that, you know, in spite of herself.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny, when I first was reading some of his adventures, I was like, is this going to turn out not to be true? And then it was like, no, he really has been a very adventurous person. So as you were developing their relationship on the page, were you aware of trying to avoid any sort of like cliche romance, or did you find yourself working hard at like creating a very unique and individual relationship for them? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so, because I think in one of my drafts somebody read it and said, oh, this is a romance novel. And I thought, oh no, I don't want to write a romance novel.
Right.
You know, and I wanted there to be some question, are they going to get together or aren't they?
Right.
Because, you know, he's all gung-ho, of course, in spite of his actual, you know, reluctance that he's not admitting to settle down. And she's very reluctant and sees...
Careful.
Sees, you know, him as... He's so reckless and, you know, I wouldn't want to get together with that. So,
yeah.
So just developing some backs and forth in that, where, oh, they get together, they make love, it's wonderful, and then he doesn't call for a month, and, you know, and she's, uh-oh.
Right, yeah. He leaves town for a while, and...
Yeah.
Yeah. It's too bad, though, like, I don't have any problem with romances, but if it's not what you're trying to write, I don't think it's a helpful feedback to be told that you're writing in a certain genre for a certain niche audience that is only looking for that aspect of a book.
Mm-hmm.
When, in fact, this is a much larger story than just mm-hmm. that story. But mm-hmm. you don't want to leave love out of a book because of the fear of being writing romance, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think that sometimes genre can be very muddying as we work.
Yeah.
I would love to. Can I just read another little paragraph? I loved this.
Oh, yeah.
If I can find it. This is Mona, and she's listening to music. I think she's in her car. This is the paragraph. There's something about music that doesn't honor the passage of time, that bypasses all the healing and growth, the results of working through, the transformation into a new and mature self. The music just stays in something deeper than the cells that die and are replaced. It remains in the body, or maybe in the air around it, or in the atmosphere, or in the stratosphere. And when she heard the song again, she was back in that place where sensation and emotion converged, a place she thought she had left long ago. I thought that was a lovely paragraph, and it really conveyed something so real about how music affects us, you know. And I suppose it's probably all of the senses. You know, a smell can do the same thing to bring you to a certain place in time, but music really can do that, and I thought that was really lovely. So... I don't think I have a question about that. I just wanted
thanks, yeah.
Do you remember writing that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's absolutely true for me.
Yeah.
You know, hearing Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, it takes me right back to a place where I was.
Yeah.
And a boy I was, you know, dating.
Yeah. All right, there's something that we haven't talked about at all yet. That there's an aspect of magic in this otherwise realistic book, or magical realism, or I don't know how you would describe it. I wonder if you could talk about including that and your how that came to be in this book.
And that also brings up the question: what's the line between magic and spirituality?
Yes.
Yeah. You know, the stone circles, I had this mountain hermit who originally was sort of...
Gus.
Yeah, Gus, and he was just sort of up there, and Then you know, I thought about the stone circles in Vermont and realized that there were some, and you know, he could be a part of that. He could have discovered that, and so that's what I did. And
maybe just give a little bit of information about the stone circles for people who don't know.
There are quite a few stone circles in New England, actually, and they're similar to the stone circles in England and Ireland. And carbon dating has shown that they're actually of similar age. So there's all this, you know, research and studying about where did they come from and who put them there. At first they thought, well, it was the Native Americans who put them there. But Native Americans, it turns out, in that region were not building things out of stone. Now the thinking is, well, it was Celtic people who came from the old world and did that. Mm-hmm. Anyways, that sort of creates a mystery.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to have some mystery there about that. And
yeah, it was wonderful. I loved that too. Yeah. You know, it kind of like tugged me in yet another direction. And Gus living out in the woods. And
yeah.
He was an interesting character. His role was interesting. Sometimes I felt like he makes people uncomfortable, but not necessarily always in a bad way. So how did is he based on any real hermit that you read about or heard about, or you just wanted to have somebody living off the grid?
I don't think he was based on a real person. I just remember one time hiking out in the woods around Thetford, where we used to live, and a man just appeared, a man with long, beautiful long hair all the way down to his waist, perfectly combed, and he just, you know, he was obviously high on something, and he just started talking to us, and that was interesting that someone would just appear out of the woods like that.
Yeah.
So,
did you have the sense he lived there?
He did live there, but yeah. it wasn't quite as remote as where Gus lives.
Okay, interesting. All right, great. Are you writing anything new now?
Well, sporadically, put it that way.
Are you in an active book tour right now? I know that this book has just barely come out. So do you have a lot of events coming up?
Mm-hmm. Yep, I'll be in Rutland next week, September 28th. And then Manchester Depot or Manchester at the Northshire Bookstore.
Okay.
October 7th.
Okay. So that makes it hard to be writing.
Yes.
When you're busy with a book tour.
Yes.
And,
yes.
How long did it take for this book to go into production and become a book?
I would say after I finished found Dee Dee, my publisher at Green Writers Press, it was about 3 years.
Yeah. So is it hard to talk about the book, or, you know, are you finding yourself re-immersed in something that you've sort of stepped away from a little bit?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for a while I was thinking, oh, I'm so sick of this, you know. Enough already. But recently I've really gotten back into it.
It is fun, isn't it, when people start talking about what you've created. Yeah. So are you working on a new novel when you are sporadically writing, or are you working on stories? Or?
Yeah. Yeah, I've set a new challenge for myself, and that is to write a historical novel. And that's very slow because I keep writing, and then I think, you know what, I don't know if that's really true for that time period, so I have to keep, you know, looking on the internet and finding, doing more research. But it's fun. It's based on an actual event, which was a witch trial in Scotland in the 1700s.
Oh, wow.
And so that whole culture of the folk tradition and the folk healers, who were then called witches by the reformers, you know, and that was a time of Reformation in Scotland, and there were all these battles going on.
Right.
And
that's a lot of research that you would have to do.
Yeah.
That's such a totally different time and place.
Yeah.
Wow. Are you enjoying it?
Yeah, I am.
Huh. Okay. Do you know what's going to happen?
Well, I mean,
You know the history.
I know the history.
But do you know what your character's paths will be, or are you sort of learning that as you go?
I'm sort of learning as I go.
Yeah.
Okay. But it's another, you know, a spiritual conflict, because there was the old, you know, the folk tradition that was just part of Scotland, Ireland, and, you know, and these were the spiritual leaders, you know, the women. And then the reformers came in, and they were, you know, imposing Christianity on this culture.
Mm.
They were also very idealistic, you know, and they really were fighting against the Catholic Church, which was extremely corrupt in Europe at that time. So I'm trying to get into both, you know, points of view and mm-hmm. see how, you know, they both have very deep beliefs about reality and what was right and how does spirit manifest in my life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds really interesting.
Yeah.
Do you have a main character yet?
Yeah, there's two main characters. One is Isabel Gowdy, who was actually a real person and tried for witchcraft and confessed to witchcraft. Her confession is the most complete verbatim confession from that time period.
Oh, wow. Huh.
Yeah.
How old was she?
Well, nobody knows exactly. We think she was around 30, maybe in her 30s.
Huh. Okay. Interesting. You mentioned Dee Dee Cummings a minute ago, who's mm-hmm. been on my show, and she's the editor and publisher for Green Writers Press.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about the experience of getting Wild Mountain published. What was your path? Did you start out trying to find an agent and go that whole route?
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
then did you submit directly to Green Writers, or how did that go?
Both, yeah. And and there were a couple of agents who were interested in...
Was Dee Dee's the only small press you submitted to?
I think so, yeah.
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 Okay.
And she was immediately taken with it.
Oh,
she was
great.
Interested. And it felt right because she's a Vermont publisher, you know, and really focusing on Vermont writing. And this is a novel about Vermont and really focused on place and the setting.
Right.
And environmental, you know, green writers. She wants
yes.
to be green.
Yes.
So it fit. It was a good fit.
Okay. Wonderful. I was going to ask, I always ask my guests if they've read anything lately that they would recommend to listeners.
Oh, here's one that I love. My Dream of You.
Okay. Is this a novel?
It's a novel, yeah.
Lala and she's, O'Fallon?
Maybe that's how I pronounce it.
Wow. So where's she from?
She's Irish, and she was a journalist. And the novel is very unconventional. It doesn't have, you know, a beginning. I mean, it does have a thread and a narrative, but her writing is very flowing, and she goes into all kinds of different areas, and it's very poetic. And she makes a lot of references to poetry and Shakespeare and developing as a woman in a very misogynistic society.
Oh, okay. My Dream of You. Huh. Riverhead Books. Great.
And I'm reading this one.
Oh,
Wolf Hall.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful.
My next novel is set in the 17th century.
Yeah.
And this is the 16th century. Outlanders is the 18th century.
I was thinking of Outlanders a little bit when you were describing your book. That's
so my book is 100 years before Outlanders.
Okay.
And a whole different...
Did you read the Outlander series?
Yeah.
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 They're very evocative and
mm-hmm.
fun. Yeah. I would love to read one more quote from your website.
Really?
So you say, essay writing is a form of reflecting on whatever is happening in my life or the world. So do you write a lot of essays?
Yeah. You know, I was a parish pastor,
yes.
so I was sort of schooled in sermon writing, and at one point was writing sermons every week, and so you kind of get into a flow of that format, mm-hmm. you know, which is about maybe two pages, and That's kind of the way I write essays, though they're not sermons now.
And where were you a pastor?
I was an interim pastor and never actually installed anywhere. But I was started in Delaware, two small churches in southern Delaware, and then in Massachusetts and New Hampshire.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. So do you ever consider collecting your sermons into some sort of collection?
I thought of that, but that sounds like a lot of work.
You've kept them all.
Yeah, except most of them are in note form.
Oh, because I was going to say, if you've written them, then you have the sermons, but maybe you did you sort of speak from notes instead of writing everything out?
Most of the time, yeah.
Shoot.
Also, I think, you know, my spiritual life has really evolved from then. So I still think of myself as Christian, but I'm also much more of a universalist.
Yeah, okay. So you'd probably have to kind of look back and see if you agree with yourself on some of your thoughts.
Yeah.
Now, when you write essays now, I know you have a blog on your website. Is that where they mostly go, or do you publish them elsewhere?
Yeah, mostly on my blog, and I have a couple. One is on Women on Writing website, WOW, that's coming up, and that's about my writing life. Which is
great.
Which is not, you know, I don't sit down every single day and write for 5 hours in the morning, which I always feel like I should do. But
yeah. So when do you write? We did talk about that.
Well, sometimes I do that, and sometimes I just have periods where I just don't write. Like I'm on this book tour, and I'm, you know, focusing on that, and then I come back to the writing. Sometimes I write at night. I find, you know, sometimes writing at night is really productive because you're tired and you're not, you know, you're not really censoring, or, you know, ideas are just coming, and I'm not kind of limiting myself by thinking, oh, I shouldn't write, you know, I should be,
right. Yeah, right. That's interesting. I don't think I've ever tried writing at night because I assume I'm too tired, but maybe I should try it. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. So I just have one last question for you, Nancy. There is a storyline in this book that has to do with gay rights and marriage freedom. Mm-hmm. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about taking on a controversial or political subject in fiction. I don't know that gay rights and marriage freedom are controversial in Vermont so much, but in a small town, still possibly could be. Certainly in other areas of the country, it still is controversial. So when you decided to write about this in fiction, did you have any guiding principles about how you were going to put it into the book, how you were going to?
Well, I think that, you know, in 2008, when this is set,
yes,
it was more controversial in Vermont. I mean, now it's pretty much accepted.
Right.
But then it was just absolutely, you know, astonishing for people to think that that could be a reality.
I'm trying to remember when the whole Take Back Vermont horrible signs were everywhere. Was that in the 90s?
That was before civil unions,
passed. Yeah. So, okay, so 2008, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, for me, that issue has always been important. And, you know, as having been part of the church, I'm still a member of the Presbyterian Church as a Presbyterian clergy. It was always important for me to vote on, you know, gay ordination. That was a big controversy in the Presbyterian, in most mainline churches.
Yeah.
For a long time. And I, you know, I had this really strong sense that that was so unjust.
Yes.
And people could be excluded like that.
Yes. So in putting it into fiction, did you have any, I mean, obviously it's a storyline and it's a theme that you care about, and yet we have to be careful not to lecture, which I didn't think that you did. So were you walking that line at all? Were you thinking about that, or were you just sort of writing these characters' experiences and...
I think I'm consciously aware of not lecturing, and that's what I meant in that statement about from my website, that I like to include the spiritual issues, but not
write
about them.
Right. That was, so we can just reread that.
Yeah. So I wanted to see how they, you know, manifested in people's lives, and people who felt one way or the other, you know, what they would be saying or thinking.
Yes. Yeah. I was just going to reread that. In my fiction writing, I like to integrate the psychological and spiritual, not through exposition or talking about the issues, but through exploring how these dimensions play out in the ways my characters live their lives. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So that's very applicable to this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's great. So I'm just going to mention again, the name of the book is Wild Mountain by Nancy Hayes Kilgore, published by Green Writers Press, and it's out now. And thank you so much, Nancy.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Likewise.
You're listening to WBTV-LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3 WBTV.org and live on your radio at 99.3 FM. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. And that was an interview with Vermont author Nancy Hayes Kilgore. You can learn more about Nancy's work at her website, nancykilgore.com. I will just repeat, I hope if you're enjoying this show, please consider liking it on Facebook, rating it in iTunes, or tweeting about Write the Book. Thank you so much. We are streaming. I just said this. We're streaming on 99.3wbtv.org, and we are on your radio at 99.3 FM. So this week's Write the Book prompt was generously offered by my guest, Nancy Hayes Kilgore, who is a pastoral counselor and has been a parish pastor as well. She suggests considering, what was your first spiritual experience? Where were you? What could you see and feel? What were your other senses telling you at the time? What spiritual awakening might have come out of the moment? Consider all of these questions and then use them as inspiration as you begin to write. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing Write the Book with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. So that latter one, the Podbean website, writethebook.podbean.com, that actually houses archives of every single episode of Write the Book, which is close to 400 shows. And then you can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book on Facebook for updates. And you can also access the podcast at my own website, which is SheLaughsWithoutUs.com. Listen to the show live each Monday at 3, and we are on your radio at 99.3 FM and streaming at 99.3wbtv.org. If you have a guest to suggest, or comments about the show, or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. I did get an email just recently asking me to find an author that the emailer really enjoys, so I'm working on that. I would love it if more people would do that. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and do tell all of your friends. I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. You've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV-LP Burlington, Vermont, on your radio at 99.3 FM and streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great week. Take care.